Welcome to Books and Beyond with your hosts, Karen and Louisa. Join us for half an hour of information, entertainment, reading recommendations, and beyond. Brought to you by Auckland Libraries.
I know this girl, and she works in a library, yeah.
Kia ora, everyone. We're back, and an exciting piece of news, right, Louisa, today? You might have noticed we posted an Instagram shot on the Auckland Library's Instagram of one of our Great Summer Read winners. It was David from Tupu Youth Library, who won tickets to the Auckland Blues opening game. We were very excited about that, but we were even more excited to see, as the likes began rolling in, a like from a certain account called Helen Clark NZ. Tick. I know, wasn't that so exciting? Well spotted, by the way. Inspired by that tick or like on our Instagram account, thinking, oh yeah, Helen, she's back in town. I recall that she hosted a breakfast by the Minister for Women on Women's International Day, and which was actually, I think, live streamed in our central library on for those who got up at 7 a.m. in the morning and came along and listened to Helen speak. So inspired by these two events, I found the book Helen Clark Inside Stories in our library, which I'm currently reading, and thinking it would be a biography on Helen, but actually it's a series of interviews. It's a really interesting read.
Helen in her own words, as they say.
Well, Helen in other people's words, plus her own. The authors, Claudia Eiley and Dan Salmon, make documentaries. And it turns out that they did make a documentary on Helen when she was in office. I'm sorry, I can't remember. It was actually the documentaries, the interviews were conducted 2012, 2014. So she was, she had left the New Zealand political scene by then. They had so much material from these interviews, so, you know, fellow politicians and family, etc., and Helen herself, that they decided not to waste this material. And rather than it being left on the editing floor, they've put it into this book. Not quite through it yet, but it's a fascinating narrative so far, and from all these people who know her well, but also someone we're getting to know well. So if you bear with me, I shall just read one of the parts that struck me. It's by a young Labour Party colleague and staffer at the time, Jacinda Ardern.
Oh, I think I've heard of her. So, I did suspect when you said people we are getting to know, I had a slight suspicion.
That's right.
So, very good.
Yeah, that
fine.
Was the clue, wasn't it? So here we go, Jacinda Ardern. So she's the background is Helen is running for Parliament for the first time in the Piako seat in the Waikato. Jacinda says, the first seat Helen ran in was where I grew up in Morrinsville, and I can certainly identify with being someone who is of the left in a pretty conservative place. I think that plays into the fact that she was a person of strong character in that period. The woman with the long hair and the all-star shoes, and she drove a mini car. Running in a place like that, you'd have to be pretty tough.
Oh, that's great.
Isn't that cool? Yeah. Words from Jacinda?
Yeah, because it kind of describes Jacinda as well.
Exactly. You know, I mean, looking back now, the Jacinda we know, we think, well, you know, that must have had an effect on our current Prime Minister, so that was really cool. So that was my that's what I'm reading at the moment, Karen.
Well,
inspiring woman.
Inspiring woman, but especially the Helen Clark plays right into what I'm reading now, because I, for Women's Month, we thought about International Women's Month, what could we bring along, and I grabbed two books by two of my favorite authors who write about women's issues, feminism, and the ability to be a strong woman. They are strong women. And the first one, Rebecca Solnit, has a book out, came out last year. So Rebecca Solnit has written 20 books. So she's been around for a long time. She writes about feminism. She doesn't write novels. She's not a novelist. She writes about feminism, indigenous history, popular power, social change. I'm taking this last quote here from her website. Social change and insurrection, wandering and walking, hope and disaster. But her last book last year was called The Mother of All Questions. And this is a cheeky title which refers to the question which gave birth to the book, which was that she had gone to a conference and she was there to speak about her books. And one of the members of the audience or the journalist wanted to ask her the question, why did she not, well, not wanted to ask her the question of all the questions to choose, why did she not have children? Which reminded me a lot of what Jacinda and Helen had both had been subjected to in their entire time in power, was always the question about whether they were having children, why did they have or not have children. And she says, so we had to talk about why I didn't rather than about the books that I did have. And another time, for instance, she's asked about her relationship, whether her relationship with her father, who was an abusive father, was why she didn't have a life partner. And she was saying, well, what's this astonishing assumption that that was what I intended to do with my life, look for a life partner. And she says, I have done what I set out to do in my life, and what I set out to do was not what the interviewer presumed. I set out to write books, to be surrounded by generous, brilliant people, and to have great adventures. Men, romances, flings, and long-term relationships have been some of those adventures, and so have remote deserts, Arctic seas, mountaintops, uprisings and disasters, and the exploration of ideas, archives, records, and lives.
And sounds like a life well lived.
Absolutely. And one other thing that you might not know, but if you heard the term mansplaining,
you will have.
Oh my goodness. Okay, mansplaining.
Okay.
Have you ever been buttonholed by a man who starts to explain something to you that you know fully well, and though you respond with intelligent answers, you tend to keep the discourse goes on, continuing to explain to you? And it was in 2010, I think, that she wrote an essay called Men Explain Things to Me. The book came out in 2014, but I think there was an essay earlier. And she's talking to a man who's explaining a subject to her that she has just written a book about. And her friend says, they're at a party, and the friend says, actually, you know, Rebecca's just written a book about that. And he, like, completely misses it and goes on and continues to explain the subject at length. And so the word that came out from that was mansplaining, which is basically you're presumed to be unqualified to talk on a subject, and the man is always more qualified.
Uh-huh.
But the book that I brought along today is A Field Guide to Getting Lost. So this is, I said earlier when she was talking about what she likes to write about, and she said walking and wandering. So being lost is another topic she comes back to again and again. Oh. Partly related, yes?
No, I was going to say, I'm always looking for companions to go hiking or walking with around the world.
You would love this book.
How do I find this woman?
You would love this book. This book is called The Field Guide to Getting Lost. And she refers back at one point, so her family is Jewish, and like all Jewish families, there are some lost people there, the people that were not able to get out of Europe in the 1930s or did not want to get out because they thought that they would stick it out there. And so she talks about that. And then she talks about one of her ancestors from Eastern Europe did leave Europe, but got lost on the way to the west coast of the United States, where her husband is sent for. Her husband went ahead. When he had enough money for her passage, he sent her the ticket, and she just never arrived. So Rebecca Solnit, like me, we talked last week in Pacifica about the places that you grew up in, in California. And so she says, this is my reading, enjoy, Rebecca Solnit. I used to imagine all the things that could have happened between the two places. Picture her getting off on a train somewhere on the prairie, getting lost and staying lost, starting up an unimaginable new life, unlike the one allotted to her by her family and her ethnicity, stepping out of the noisy compression of an Isaac Bashevis Singer story into the expansive calm of a Willa Cather novel. The vast spaces of the American West have always invited travelers to lose their past like so much luggage and reinvent themselves. I realize now that it was my own desire to step out of the train, the car, the conversation, the obligation into the landscape that I gave this imagined ancestor. I grew up with landscape as recourse, with the possibility of exiting the horizontal realm of social relations for a vertical alignment with earth and sky, matter and spirit. Vast open spaces speak best to this craving, the spaces I myself first found in the desert and then in the western grasslands. Such spaces are not as easy to enter as might be imagined. They are often the private land one passes on the way to the public lands of trees and steepness. So there you
Thank
go.
Thank you.
Field Guide to Getting Lost. And the other book that I brought along was one of my other favorite women writers, who is Roxane Gay, who in many ways is similar to Rebecca Solnit, you know, charging ahead, making a case for feminism and women, but at the same time, women's stories, but at the same time, very different character and very different style of writing. So Roxane Gay is also outraged at things like men asking her questions like, you know, why do you not have children or have children, or why are you, you know, do you have body problems? But she, her outrage is, I think, more pointed, more sarcastic. She really annihilates her targets. She's not as meditative.
She's a bit more of an activist, is she?
I think outrage is the term. Whereas I sometimes say she's younger than Rebecca Solnit. Sometimes I feel that Rebecca Solnit is looking at things with a longer view, and Roxane Gay is right here and now. This is what I want to have happen.
You can even... listeners can't see it, but you can even see the difference. I'm just listening to your narrative there, but also I can see the books. And the books, the covers are completely different too, exactly as you describe the writers. So we have book covers to match.
Yeah, so Rebecca Solnit has a close-up, extreme close-up of an oil painting, which is bluish and whitish with a little bit of dark underneath. And Roxane Gay, this wonderful book of essays called Bad Feminist, is the entire front page pure white, taken over with a hot pink, because Roxane Gay does often vindicate her desire to be able to have pink as a favorite color and still be a feminist, which is part of the play of the Bad Feminist. So the book is called Bad Feminist, Roxane Gay, out there, four words to take up the entire front cover. On the other hand, Roxane Gay also is noted for an extreme vulnerability and for... being committed to presenting her vulnerability honestly and not trying to hide it, and actually, as she says at one point, showing you the ferocity of my hunger. She says, I want you to see what I hunger for and what my truth has allowed me to create. And this is another book of hers, Hunger, which you should also read. But, and the last thing about her, so she's got the dark side, the vulnerable side, the outrage side, but she's also very, very funny. So the quick read that I've picked today for us is about women's fiction, because we are a book talk show, and people who tune in do like to read and will have come across the term women's fiction. So she says... The term women's fiction is so wildly vague, it is mostly useless. The book covers are often marked by pastels, the silhouettes of well-accessorized women, or a few body parts ambiguously splayed. In the New York Times Book Review, Chloe Sharma writes, "A plague of women's backs is upon us in the book cover world." Have you noticed that? How many books written by women have a woman facing the other way? You're looking at her back, often wearing... one item of clothing, which is red, and then the rest are all dark.
Yes, it's true. And I was just trying to think. I mean, we don't actually have a term men's fiction, do we?
No, we don't. We don't. Allow me to go on. We'll address that.
Making very, very good points here.
She goes on to cite an alarming number of recent book covers featuring a woman's back, her nape exposed, as if we dare not see a woman's face. Sharma concludes, sex sells, and this reference to the body without obvious objectification must appeal to an industry that overwhelmingly attracts and employs women. So we're still putting the body on the cover, but you, because we know that we want you, women, to write our books, to buy our books. Therefore, we're going to, you know, avoid the obvious objectification, show you the body from the back. Women's fiction is a label designed to sell a certain kind of book to a certain kind of reader. As writers, we have little control over how our books are marketed or the covers our books receive. And let's be clear, women's fiction and the accompanying, often cloying cover designs are marketing choices meant to either encompass the subject matter of a book or its author or both. We are beholden to these arbitrary categories that are in many ways insulting to men, women, and writing. And so she says, I'm just going to skip forward here, the label women's fiction is often used with such disdain. I hate how woman has become a slur. I hate how some women writers twist themselves into knots to distance themselves from women's fiction, as if we have anything to be ashamed of as women who write what we want to write. I don't care if my fiction is labeled as women's fiction. I know what my writing is and what it isn't. Someone else's arbitrary designation doesn't change that. If readers discount certain topics as unworthy of their attention, if readers are going to judge a book by its cover or feel excluded from a certain kind of book because the cover is, say, pink, the failure is with the reader, not the writer. To read narrowly and shallowly is to read from a place of ignorance. And she says, reading is one of the purest things I do. I derive a great deal of joy from reading. And she wants everyone to remember that Reading is her first love, and don't lose sight of the joy of reading just because we're focused on the bitter realities of how that material finds its way into the world.
That was fascinating.
One of my new true loves, Roxane Gay. Yeah, she was at the Writers' Festival last year. She's an amazing, amazing woman.
That was a really good insight into the world of publishing for us. I am going to pay particular attention now when selecting my books. Don't judge a book by its cover. and I also, listening to you there, Karen, thinking of the hashtag for International Women's Day and Year and Month, which I think is hashtag push for progress. And, so that reading really resonated with that as a... let's make some conscious sort of
efforts through the categories. So we say books and beyond. It means beyond the categorizing.
And we did note before you read that piece how the effect of the cover.
Yeah, that's
on
right.
Us. So fantastic. Yeah. Thank you for sharing that with us. I bought another book.
You brought some more books for celebrating
International
Women's
Month. But I don't know how to
follow
up with that now, Karen. Actually, let's do my children's picture book. Rosie Revere, Engineer. I believe it's very popular in the library with parents selecting it for their girls. Just putting it out there, Rosie Revere, Engineer. So Rosie is a young girl who...
So this is a play on Rosie the Riveter. We're assuming everyone's caught that, but perhaps not.
Yeah, that's true.
Rosie the Riveter being the personality that was created in America to point out how women could go to work in factories and win the war for the U.S. on the home front.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, and we all know the image.
From the vintage postcards.
The lady with the scarf.
Yeah.
But I'm not sure how well that's translated into the picture book, where children... parents are encouraging or trying to open a different world of profession for their daughters, but there is a bit on the back of the book about the historical background.
Yep.
of
Rosie the Riveter.
Rosie the Riveter, that's right.
Not Riveter, but the Riveter.
So now she's Rosie Revere, the engineer, yeah. And how she aspires to be an engineer just quietly all to herself because she feels she doesn't, it's not a career that people take seriously. But she meets a great aunt who does so. And it's very hard to read a picture book when you're doing a radio show, it's in rhyming text, as a lot of picture books are, and it's a very, very cool book.
It's the one step beyond Rosie the Riveter in the sense that Rosie the Riveter with women were just supplying muscle power, and here Rosie Revere, engineer, is supplying brain power. So this is the modern world, this is what we need more of, and she's stepped into the future. Good for her.
Go Rosie. And a great read for mothers, daughters, fathers, daughters, etc. So that was my little contribution. Inspirational, strong woman themed show today.
Yeah.
Just remembering that, if you've got a daughter, the world of possibilities are there for her.
And she can discover them in the library. She can pursue them and discover them in the library. Is that another book you have underneath Helen Clark?
Oh, yes.
Oh, I remember you telling me about this.
Well, yeah, I wanted to talk about Charlotte Badger, the first white woman to live in New Zealand.
But I thought you said you hadn't gotten to that yet.
That's another read in progress.
That's one.
Right. Which we mentioned in our magazine show a few weeks ago. When we were talking about strong, inspirational woman, I record a book I read a couple of years ago, A Singular Woman, The Untold Story of Barack Obama's Mother. So it's a biography. I read The Dreams of My Father by Barack Obama. I think it was his first book. Loved it. He was in office at the time, and I remember thinking, how did this happen? How did he become the president for the United States?
Well, I think, no, the book came out before he became president. I'm quite sure I remember my mother reading it when he was a candidate.
So it was a really good read.
Oh, you were reading it when he was in the presidency.
So it was a really good read in that respect. So you know, it makes you think about, you know, how did he become this extraordinary person? So I saw the book, A Singular Woman, on the shelves in my local library and picked it up. So his mother was actually named Stanley Ann Dunham. So straight away, you think, well, you know,
How does that reverberate with a woman being given a man's name?
Yeah, that's right.
Actually, interestingly enough, I have an aunt named Stanley my double tie to Barack Obama. One is that I have an aunt named Stanley who lived with it very well her whole life, did complain a lot about in her youth, but in the end, I think really understood that was, you know, taking the path less traveled by. But also my uncle, her brother, worked in the factory in Wichita making Boeing planes where Barack Obama's grandmother worked during the war, being a Rosie the Riveter.
Yeah,
so,
wow.
Yeah, just
connecting the
amazing
dots there.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I guess if you've given a male's name at birth, you are going to grow up to be a little bit different, aren't you?
Yeah. And he makes doesn't he have a lovely thing about the dreams of my father that you were saying before?
Thank you for reminding me. I think sometimes that had I known she would not survive her illness, I might have written a different book. Less a meditation on the absent parent, I think he's referring to his dad there.
Yeah.
And more a celebration of the one who was the single most constant in my life. So that was a lovely tribute.
And that's the dedication. That's like a dedication. What is that? It's like a...
It's actually a preface that he wrote in his book.
Epigram. I think of the name. Yeah.
Which they've inserted as the preface in this book. Because we don't really get to know her that well.
Yeah.
I mean, she still remains a bit of a mystery woman. We read about her life, but we don't really know how she felt and what sort of made her tick. So she still remains a mystery, but... we get to know a little bit more about the making of the son, her son, and also a daughter that she had in Indonesia.
And maybe we can look forward to a book from Barack after we had Dreams to My Father. So as he points out, and this is, I think, true, a lot of people know this is true about a lot of children, you fixate on the parent that you don't have rather than on the parent that you do have, who's the one who's actually 24 hours a day looking after you and bringing you up. And so he's written the book about his absent father, the hole in his life, but he still has to write the book. We could look forward, now that he's retired from possibly for a while from politics, he might come
back.
Shall
we write to him and suggest it to him?
Yes, I think that's a great idea. Maybe he's listening to our show. Barack, if you're listening, we'd like a book about your mother from you. So after Dreams from My Father, Dreams from Your Mother.
Exactly, because that's what I was thinking. You know, she still remains a mystery in this book, and we know she was a fiercely independent woman, hardworking, that's for sure, devoted to her anthropological work on the island of Java in Indonesia. We learned that she wasn't always very good with money, but she was always there for her children. Neither were neglected, thanks to her parents who were living in Hawaii still while she was in Indonesia. So what a fantastic book. It would, you know, resolve the mystery.
Yeah. And speaking of mystery, you've given me a perfect opening to ask you, would you like to hear about a treasure from the basement?
Ooh. Ah.
Treasures from the basement.
So thinking about these stories about strong women, I remembered a blog post I'd written about outrageous women, which is, of course, the term that society has always given to women who are nonconformists are usually outrage society. But men who are nonconformists, of course, are considered adventurous. And let's see where they're taking us now. And I had written about this, about a number of women, one of whom was included in this book. So this is a book from the 1950s, written by by a woman, a British writer and journalist named Leslie Blanche, who was, in my memory, she's always responsible for Vogue magazine's food pages with the glorious kind of food porn glossy pictures. But I think it's a word association with her last name, Blanche, as in blanching your vegetables. It's actually, she didn't write about food. She was the features editor for Vogue. But you can certainly see in this book, this is why it's a great Treasures in the Basement, the type of writing that was happening from a Vogue features editor in the 1950s. So she had a very adventurous life, actually, Leslie Blanche. She traveled around all kinds of remote areas and married the Romain Gary, who was a diplomat in the French diplomatic service, born in Russia, who was also, I'm quite sure, married to Jean Seberg, I'm sure, the actress in a lot of the Nouvelle Vague French movies in the same sort of period of time, so possibly after having divorced Leslie Blanche. Life with Leslie Blanche must have been a bit difficult, so she traveled in the East and the West and in the Sahara, and she lived, so her book is called The Wilder Shores of Love, and it follows four women whose stories, you can really feel her aspiring to live similar stories, possibly in her travels with Romain Gary. And in fact, she then, years later, wrote her own autobiography, and it was called something like My Wilder Shores of Love. And she, similar to, do you know the Eloise children's books?
Yes.
So did you know that the author of Eloise used to like to dress in little dresses and talk in an Eloise voice and live at the plaza?
Wow.
A lot of people don't know that. Interesting side on author.
Another outrageous woman.
Yeah. Another outrageous woman. Might have been possibly a bit tiresome also, but certainly wrote some of the best children's classics ever written.
Ms. Blanche has traveled, is married to this diplomat, is traveling towards these exotic places around the world, and has written a book about
four outrageous women who in periods of life in which independence was not something that women were supposed to aspire to, all made their own independent way to, as she calls it, the Lodestar East. Ah. So the first one is Aimée Dubuc de Rivery, a convent girl captured by corsairs and sold into the harem of the Grand Turk. Then we have Lady Ellenborough, a society beauty who fled London for the Syrian tent of Sheikh Medjuel El Mizrab. Then we have Isabel Burton, whose explorer husband's love for the East, this is Richard Burton, the most famous explorer of Victorian times, became her passion. And Isabel Eberhardt, who explored the Sahara disguised as a boy. They all escaped from the constraints of 19th century Europe and fled to the Middle East, where they found love, fulfillment, and glowing horizons of emotion and daring. And I've got this piece here, so this is where she's talking about Isabel Burton. So Isabel Burton is, I'm quite sure, I hope nobody out there is going to find that I've got the wrong person, but I'm quite sure she's the famous one who received the cable from Richard Burton when they were going to be moving on from one of his diplomatic postings, and it said, pack and follow, basically. So she was in a way a bit of his servant, but it was her destiny because she had met as a young woman an old mysterious woman named Hagar who had told her that her destiny was to go to the Lodestar East. And she passionately, her final book on Richard Burton, she wrote a book about Richard Burton, and she says, reader, I have paid, I have packed. Oh, that was it, because the telegram was pay, pack, and follow. So she says, reader, I have paid, I have packed, and I have suffered. I am waiting to join his caravan. I am waiting for a welcome sound, the tinkling of his camel bell, which was not going to tinkle because he was dead at that point. But she's reminiscing about all her life. She's been waiting for the tinkling of his camel bell, and she still was. It would take her to the great beyond with him. So we have
to fulfill her destiny.
Exactly. So Leslie Blanche finishes the story where she goes to visit the tomb where the two are buried together. And she says she finds a tired-looking old woman, just happens to find, you wonder if that's a bit of literary invention, cutting the grass nearby the tomb. And she says, oh, yes, I used to be able to go inside. You know, it's all locked up now, but it was very lovely. The lights went on, you opened the door, and little bells rang. And so Leslie Blanche says, isn't that wonderful? I left by the cinder path. And she says, neglected in life and death, they are still together, never long apart, one soul in two bodies. Hagar's mysterious whispers echo down the years. It had all come true. Richard and the East, .. the Lodestar East. Oh. Yeah, so that's our show for today, I guess, with the end with the
I was so enjoying listening to it. We only got one of the ladies' stories out of that
I wanted
book.
To move on to Isabel Eberhardt, but you'll have to get the book out, copy in the Simplicity
Half an hour's
Library
just not
basement.
Long enough.
It's not. Let us know what you would like to hear on the show. Contact us through the Auckland Library's Facebook page, right?
Yes.
And we'll
Planet FM.
Be back next week.
Ka kite anō. Every day.